Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Sudan's conflict has so far killed more than 20,000 people. This is an underestimate, by the way. Displaced over 10 million people inside the country and forced another 2 million to flee to neighboring countries. This is the largest internal displacement of people in the world today.
A UN fact-finding mission reports harrowing human rights violations by both sides in Sudan's brutal civil war. We'll look at a new investigative report uncovering gruesome details and footage of an ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur. And we'll speak with Human Rights Watch about their new report calling for an expanded arms embargo on Sudan. Then Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier turned 80 years old this week in prison after nearly a half century behind bars for a crime he says he did not commit.
He wouldn't allow me to put up a defense and manufactured evidence, manufactured witnesses, tortured witnesses. The list just goes on.
We'll speak with Leonard Peltier's legal defense team and with the president of the Indigenous-led NDN Collective. Then, how we do freedom, rising against fascism.
It's a day-long education, activation on what is fascism and what we do to stop it.
We'll speak with V, the playwright formerly known as Eve Ensler. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli strikes have killed at least 40 people across Gaza today, as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is once again calling for an immediate ceasefire following Israel's massacre at the UN-run Al-Jiyuni school, which killed at least 18 people Wednesday, including six UN workers, the deadliest day in UNRWA's history. The World Health Organization said Thursday it had evacuated about 100 people in need of medical treatment from Gaza to the United Arab Emirates and called for regular evacuations to resume after Israel's assault decimated Gaza's health system. This is a cancer patient awaiting evacuation.
I'm suffering from Hodgkin's lymphoma, and this type of cancer spreads very quickly. In 1 or 2 months, it spreads throughout your entire body, unlike other types of cancer. My trip was extremely tiring, and I came here to the south so I can travel and get treated outside the country by God's will.
In related news, the WHO says a quarter of Palestinians in Gaza wounded by Israel's ongoing assault have life-changing injuries. The UN is warning the Palestinian economy, which was already devastated before October 7th due to Israel's occupation and blockade, is in free fall and could completely collapse. The body of Ayşenur Ezgi Egi, the 26-year-old Turkish-American activist who was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank during a peaceful protest, has arrived in Turkey ahead of her funeral. On Thursday, Ayşenur's father, Mehmet Suat Egi, praised Turkey for investigating the killing and called on the U.S. to do the same.
America is a different country. When there is injustice or torment towards its citizens, or they are killed in any country in the world, it lands on that country like the eagle on its emblem. But when the subject is Israel, there is more of an effort to dodge it. But I want to believe that people will listen to their conscience.
Earlier this week, The Washington Post published an investigation corroborating eyewitness accounts that the protests Ayşenur Ezgi Egi had been taking part in were already over when Israeli soldiers opened fire, killing her. Meanwhile, three top Democrats from Eisenhower's home state of Washington, Senators Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, and Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, called on the Biden administration to investigate her killing. On Wednesday, hundreds of people gathered at a Seattle beach for a vigil honoring the recent University of Washington graduate. A North Dakota judge struck down the state's near-total abortion ban Thursday, ruling North Dakota's constitution ensures the right to an abortion before fetal viability. While the ruling's a major victory for abortion rights, North Dakota no longer has any abortion clinics after the overturning of Roe v. Wade triggered the state's ban. If the ruling is not overturned in an appeal or the state legislature does not pass a new ban, North Dakota could join Minnesota as a haven for patients seeking abortion care in the Midwest. Some 33,000 Boeing workers in Washington State and Oregon are walking off the job after overwhelmingly rejecting a new contract. It's Boeing's first strike in 16 years and will halt production on most of its aircrafts, including its troubled 737 MAX. Workers are seeking pay raises of 40%. The tentative agreement only pledged to raise wages by 25%. In related news, hotel workers in Boston, New Haven, and San Diego have launched the second wave of a phased strike that started at hotels around the United States on Labor Day. A federal jury in Florida has found members of a Pan-Africanist group guilty of conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord and interfere in U.S. elections. Activists with the African People's Socialist Party face up to 5 years in federal prison. They plan to appeal. Prosecutors argued the group's activities were not protected by the First Amendment since they were done at the direction of a Russian operative named Alexander Inoval. The defense argued the government aimed to censor the group after members criticized U.S. foreign policy. Jurors acquitted three of the activists, known as the Uhuru Three, on a more serious charge of acting as agents of a foreign government. Attorney Mutaki Akbar spoke after the verdict.
We had 12 people from this community that probably don't agree with most of the stuff that they heard, but understood their right to do it, one, and their two, their sovereignty in doing so, that they were doing it on their own behalf for African people. So I think that sends a message to the government that these political prosecutions probably won't work.
To see our interview with one of those on trial, Omali Yeshitela, chair of the African People's Socialist Party, about the trial of the Uhuru Three, visit democracynow.org. A judge in Georgia has dismissed two more charges against Donald Trump and one charge against some of his co-defendants in the state's 2020 election subversion case. Trump now faces eight charges in the racketeering conspiracy, down from the original 13. In other Trump news, the former president says he will not take part in any more debates against Kamala Harris before the election. In Springfield, Ohio, a bomb threat on Thursday prompted authorities to order the evacuation of City Hall and several municipal buildings. Mayor Rob Bruce said the threat came in an email from someone who cited frustration over the city's resettlement of Haitian immigrants. This comes after Springfield city manager denied false racist claims made by former President Trump and vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance that Haitian immigrants were eating people's dogs and cats. Several Democratic senators have criticized the Biden administration's move to send $1.3 billion in military funding to Egypt, citing widespread human rights abuses by the authoritarian government of General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. A portion of the money, less than a quarter, was conditioned on Egypt improving its human rights record. On Thursday, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy wrote, quote, "It's no secret Egypt remains a deeply repressive autocratic state. I see no good reason to ignore that fact by waiving these requirements," he said. This comes as press freedom groups are demanding Egyptian authorities drop all charges against four journalists recently detained and held incommunicado. The disappearances of Ashraf Omar, Khaled Mamdou, Ramadan Guida, and Yasser Abu Ella have sparked fear and trauma among Egyptian journalists. At least two of them have allegedly been tortured. In Nigeria, people are searching for their loved ones after major flooding killed at least 30 people, submerged entire neighborhoods, and displaced tens of thousands of people in the northeast.
I have one son, and I have not seen or heard from him in 3 days. We got out on Tuesday after the flood overpowered us. It was really hard for us to get out, but thanks to the soldiers who helped us to safety. Right now, we are still searching for my son. No headway yet. We pray to God to help us in this situation.
Democratic lawmakers Thursday unveiled the Polluters Pay Climate Fund Act that would force fossil fuel companies to pay into a fund that addresses the harm and damages they caused, unquote. In related news, pressure's mounting for the Biden administration to cancel all new liquefied natural gas export licenses after a judge recently lifted a pause on new LNG export approvals and after a new study found that LNG has a 33% greater greenhouse gas footprint than coal. Here in New York, Police Commissioner Edward Caban resigned Thursday at the request of Mayor Eric Adams. Caban's resignation came just days after federal agents searched his home and seized his cell phone. Agents also raided the homes of a top mayoral advisor, two deputy mayors, and the New York City schools chancellor. It's one of the four separate corruption investigations by federal prosecutors targeting Adams' inner circle. And Chilean President Gabriel Boric says he will push for the repeal of a highly contested amnesty law that has long barred investigations into crimes against humanity committed during General Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship. On Wednesday, September 11th, Boric attended a ceremony marking the 51st anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup, which overthrew elected President Salvador Allende and ushered in Pinochet's 17-year dictatorship, during which thousands of people were murdered, tortured, and disappeared. This is Jaime Vivanco, a relative of some of the victims.
Our society still does not assume that it has an historical duty to vindicate the disappeared detainees, the politically executed, and the tortured people. We must learn from this and understand that if we do not assume this as a society, then never again is not real and can be repeated.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Sudan, where a U.N. fact-finding mission has reported harrowing human rights violations, many of which amount to war crimes committed by both the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Members of the U.N. mission described indiscriminate attacks by the warring parties on civilians, schools, hospitals, water and power supplies. Civilians have also been subjected to torture, arbitrary detention and gruesome sexual violence by both sides.
In the context of the current conflict, civilians, an overwhelming majority of whom are women and children, women and girls, were and continue to be targeted with sexual violence, in particular rape, gang rape, by both parties to the conflict. Members of the RSF, in particular, have perpetrated sexual violence on a large scale in the context of attacks on cities in Darfur region and the greater Khartoum area.
Sudan's military and the RSF rejected calls by the UN experts to deploy an international force to protect civilians from the devastating war that erupted in April of 2023, so far killing more than 20,000 people, displacing some 13 million from their homes. This is the World Health Organization's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, speaking from Port Sudan.
Sudanese are suffering through a perfect storm of crisis. Over 500 days of conflict, the largest level of displacement in the world, famine in some parts and risk of this in others, 25.6 million people, over half of Sudanese population, are expected to face high levels of acute food insecurity.
After over 16 months of fighting, much of Sudan's healthcare system has also collapsed, leading to the outbreak of disease, including cholera. Massive floods and torrential rains in recent weeks have compounded the catastrophe with dozens of reported deaths, the further destruction of vital infrastructure, and more disruptions to the delivery of life-saving humanitarian aid. For more, we're joined by two guests. Yusra Abahir is Africa correspondent at Sky News. Her latest piece, titled Sudan War, Massacre on the Streets, part of a joint investigation with Lighthouse Reports, The Washington Post, and Le Monde, uncovering gruesome details of footage of the June 2023 ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur's town of Khartoum. Their investigations, the first time visual evidence has emerged showing fighters linked with the RSF directly involved in the extrajudicial killings of unarmed civilians. She's joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. And in Paris, we're joined by Jean-Baptiste Galopin, senior crisis, conflict, and arms researcher at Human Rights Watch, which has just released a new report titled Fanning the Flames, Sudanese Warring Parties, Access to New Foreign-Made Weapons and Equipment. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's go to Yusra first in Nairobi, Kenya. Talk about what's happening in your home country of Sudan right now, what people should understand about the depth of this catastrophe.
Well, Amy, I think everyone can remember the genocide in the early 2000s, 2003 genocide in Darfur, where there was outcry, outrage around inhumanity that was being seen in the Darfur region, the suppression of people's voices that was happening in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. There was an outcry and a rejection of the violence happening there. I was in school in Sudan at the time, and though the military regime had completely censored press from speaking on the conflict in Darfur in 2003, we heard from it from outside. We heard about it from the international community because the noise about it was so difficult to ignore, even in the seat of power in Khartoum. Now it's the opposite. Now it is complete apathy and neglect. The global community is essentially turning away 20 years on, when we have similar atrocities happening in the Darfur region and spreading to the country. I got a message earlier from a source who helped us on the investigation. He asked me if the Western world was complicit, if they're in on it, because he himself is shocked to see that no one seems to care, that he feels that there's an aiding and abetting of the RSF through allies of the West, like the UAE. And there just seems to be a lot of confusion and despair about why the world doesn't seem to be taking this seriously.
Yusra, I wanted to turn to that joint investigation you just did between Sky News, Lighthouse Reports, Washington Post, and the French paper Le Monde, which uncovers these gruesome details and footage of the June 2023 ethnically motivated massacre of civilians by rapid support forces in North Darfur's town of Khartoum. The investigation marking the first time visual evidence has emerged showing fighters linked with RSF directly involved in the extrajudicial killing of unarmed civilians. This is a clip of your video report.
Safia's husband was one of the soldiers killed in the battle, but civilian men in her family were targeted too.
My three cousins and two of my brothers were stood up and shot dead. My father would have been killed too if he hadn't fled. We had to bury my brothers in the yard with some dirt and leave them behind.
Residents say they'd never seen anything like it, even compared to the 2003 conflict in Darfur, designated as genocide.
This time, these guys conquer the army, and then they come for the civilians. If you have a car, they'll take it. They'll take anything in your home. If you have pretty sisters, they'll rape them.
You can see the rest of this investigation on Sky News website, news.sky.com. Yusra Albragir was your voice that we heard there. You were the correspondent on this investigation. What shocked you most? This was a massacre that took place a year ago. But how much has things changed?
Well, we were on the border with West Darfur when the war started, and we were seeing people come out of West Darfur with bullets in them, children. I remember a three-year-old having a bullet in his hip, and they were being targeted by the Arab militias that the RSF is linked to, based solely on their ethnicity. A couple of days later, this massacre that we reported on recently happened, and it was a town-wide massacre that spread also to the displacement camp, Kassab, which was actually built to house persecuted communities from the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. So we had already seen the violence play out, and we saw it live. But what shocked me, Amy, was the videos, the visual evidence that we put forward in the report that Lighthouse shared with us. that kind of spurred on this investigation, where these tribal militiamen are celebrating over lifeless bodies of unarmed civilians, saying victory to the Arabs. They're cheering on their violence. We spent a lot of time tracking down the victims that we see in those videos, tracking down their people closest to them to understand who they were, what their relation was with the RSF, why they were being targeted in this way. And they were simply unarmed civilians. We were even told repetitively they don't have any history of altercation. One of them was a university student. One of them was a cattle herder. One of them was only 14 years old. They were found in a door-to-door hunt of civilian men of fighting age from non-Arab tribes. So to see this happen very early on, I started to feel like it was a template for the massacres and the atrocities that we saw in the months that followed. Because what happened in that town was that the army garrison was taken over by the RSF, and then they kind of sanctioned this rampage, this massacre on the town. It was the second garrison to fall in Darfur after the RSF kind of took over Khartoum. The first one in Darfur, Kabkabiya, there was very little fight. And this garrison is being credibly accused of being sold out to the RSF. Army sources told us that senior commanders colluded with the RSF before the attack. And then in the months that followed, we see a similar pattern. An abrupt withdrawal from army garrisons, the RSF takes over towns and then starts to carry out atrocities against civilians. And that is terrifying. It's terrifying because the civilians there are essentially defenseless. The army can't be trusted to protect civilians. And the RSF is currently in control of 4 out of 5 of states in Darfur.
I want to bring Jean-Baptiste Galopin into this conversation, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. If you can tell us more about fanning the flames, Sudanese warring parties' access to new foreign-made weapons and equipment, where are all these weapons coming from that are killing so many Sudanese civilians?
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. So, you know, we at Human Rights Watch, we monitor social media for evidence of crimes. And over the past year, we were shocked to see the growing number of apparently new weapons that the warring parties are using in the conflict, weapons that are kind of very sophisticated pieces of modern equipment and made abroad. So we analyzed this content and identified the equipment and published this report, which presents the equipment that we believe was newly acquired. And that includes armed drones, different types of such drones, truck-mounted multi-barrel rocket launcher systems, explosive munitions, drone jammers, as well as anti-tank guided missiles. And these weapons were made in countries such as Serbia, Russia, China, the UAE, and Iran. And both sides are using them. So we're very concerned that in the context of widespread atrocities being carried out in Sudan by both sides, these weapons are very likely to be used to commit human rights violations and war crimes. And we've actually found evidence in this report of drones used by the military being used to attack apparent civilians in the Khartoum area.
And again, name the countries where the weapons are coming from.
So this includes Serbia, Russia, China, Iran, the UAE. And so we found, for instance, that the Sudanese military is using the Mohajer 6 drone, which is really a latest generation drone manufactured by the Iranian Ministry of Defense. You know, we found the RSF using attack drones that we couldn't identify, but that are used with in tandem with thermobaric munitions that weapon crates show were first purchased by the United Arab Emirates from Serbia before finding their way to the RSF. And these weapons are used across the country, including in Darfur, but also in the Khartoum area, as well as Kordofan. And so that really illustrates that the existing arms embargo on Darfur, which was established in 2004 in the context of the Darfur conflict at the time, is really inadequate in light of the changed situation in the country. As you mentioned, today the majority of Sudan's federal states are seeing violence, and there is very little enforcement of this embargo. So the UN Security Council a few days ago voted to renew the embargo, but we actually are calling for the Security Council to expand it to the whole of Sudan to ensure these weapons, to curb the flow of weapons and protect civilians.
Can I ask Yusra, why are these countries involved with what's going on in Sudan right now, this humanitarian catastrophe? Serbia, China, Russia, UAE.
I mean, Sudan is literally a gold mine, Amy. I mean, we've got massive gold mines. We've got uranium deposits. We've got an 800-kilometer Red Sea coastline. We're also a corridor country. And we are the third largest country in Africa. I think the instability in Sudan has been exploited by international powers for a long time. But now it really is kind of up for the taking. I mean, Omar al-Bashir, the former military dictator, made his money selling Sudan for parts. He'd already had a deal with Russia before he was ousted in the 2019 revolution. He already had deals with the UAE and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia on kind of corrupt hundreds of years of leases on arable land. He'd kind of set the precedent for making money, making Sudan a lucrative business for kleptocrats. And so once he was ousted, the power vacuum was quickly filled with his henchmen, with his inspector general, who's now the army chief, and his opponent, Hemeti, the head of the RSF, was al-Bashir's favorite militiaman. He led the counterinsurgency in Darfur in the early 2000s as the head of a Janjaweed militia. So these guys have seen what al-Bashir has managed to do with the country, and they're cashing in on it. And all of these countries that are involved are definitely exploiting the vulnerability, and some of them had an active hand in suppressing the protests in 2019. I mean, both the UAE and Russia have been credibly accused of helping the government at the time to track down protesters, to lobby online propaganda campaigns, especially Russia. And this is just a continuation of that, I think.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow the story. Sky News Africa correspondent Yusra Avakhir, speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya, a Sudanese journalist, and Jean-Baptiste Galopin, senior crisis, conflict and arms researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Paris, France. We'll link to your reports at Sky News and to the Human Rights Watch investigation. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Leonard Peltier turns 80 years old in prison. He's been there for half a century. Stay with us. Anna, Anna. Arahal, Traveler by Alsada and Debouy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amnesty International is calling on President Biden to grant clemency to the indigenous leader, Leonard Peltier, who turned 80 years old Thursday after nearly half a century in prison for a crime he says he did not commit. Peltier has always maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation, his conviction riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. In a letter to President Biden last week, Amnesty International USA wrote, quote, given the ongoing unresolved concerns about the fairness of Leonard Peltier's trial and legal process, that he spent nearly 50 years in prison, his age, the recent denial of parole and compassionate release, and ongoing and chronic health issues, we're asking you to commute Leonard Peltier's sentence and release him. This is not only timely, but a necessary measure in the interests of both justice and mercy, they wrote. For more on Leonard Peltier's case, we're joined by Nick Tilson, president of the NDN Collective, an indigenous-led organization, citizen of the Oglala.